Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Teager and I'm joined as ever by Ian Wenig. Ian, hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. I just wanted to commend you for putting the sandbag in front of the studio door so we have zero risk of interruptions by small children today.
Yeah, that and the fact there's no small children in the CityWire office today, whereas, yes, listeners of last week's episode will have noted our brief and arguably cute interruption by a child as one member, not important who, but me, recorded from home that day. We haven't got any small children, but we have got a full-grown man called Sam Bojarski here in the studio with us. Sam,
how's it going? Yeah, good. Great to be back on after spending a couple weeks on the road.
Your hiatus, yeah. via Pittsburgh, Kansas, and San Diego, not in that order. And in fact,
yes, in that order. Yeah,
it wasn't that order. Okay,
yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And neat segue, because it is San Diego where we're going to start our pod today. You were both there for CityWire's first ever RIA CIO Summit in, well, it's not San Diego, is it? It's La Jolla, right? Which technically just north of San Diego?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I've not been. I'm not disparaging. I just don't know. Excellent. Okay, so you were both there for this conference. Ian, you talked a little bit about it last week because we were recording while you were out there, but I think we'll spend a bit longer on it today, and we're going to start with a sort of survey poll that we do at all our conferences, a read of the room, really, Sam. So maybe before we get straight into the poll, who was at the conference? Who have we surveyed, basically?
Yeah, so we surveyed CIOs and investment managers from roughly 35 to 40 RIAs around the country.
Excellent. Okay. And the two questions that I wanted to talk about were the first question, which was effectively sort of taking the pulse of when they think a large RIA / sort of wealth management firm might go public. And then there's a second sort of other question we should talk about, which is around kind of their outlook for asset class du jour private credit. But let's start with the idea of a wealth management IPO. Mm-hmm. I guess, what was the question and what was the answer?
Yeah, when will an RIA go public is what we asked our attendees. A full third of respondents, one third of people, said keep dreaming.
Yeah, okay.
You know.
And that was the single most popular response, was it?
The most popular one was they thought an RIA would go public and stay public, somewhere between 2028 and 2030.
Okay, which is still
about 42% said that.
Still kind of keep dreamy, isn't it? Because that's, you know, at the higher end of that, that's still 5-6 years away.
A little bit in the future.
Which is not exactly around the corner, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, and then what other? So no one. What was the nearest option they could have chosen, and how many people went for that?
2025 to 2027 was the nearest, and that was only 16% of respondents thought we'd see a successful IPO in that time frame.
Okay, and in terms of the IPO, we asked them RIA, but I suppose what we just to broaden that out, what we're sort of trying to get at is some sort of wealth management IPO.
Because
let's broaden it out to maybe broker dealers too, for example. Mm-hmm. Do we agree? Do we think that's kind of right?
Seems like it to me. I mean, yeah, RIAs have had a pretty mixed, to put it nicely, run in the public markets. I mean, yeah, we saw Focus Financial getting taken private in 2023 after a handful of years on the markets. And then just last year, we had a couple firms, CI Financial and InvestNet, agree to be taken private by consortiums of different private investors.
Yeah, okay. And we touched on this a little bit in our Odyssey of an episode last week, where we discussed the sort of the evolution of the RIA market. And Ian, in that, you gave that really good example of Hightower and how you know, the original plan there was, you know, break away from the wires, form your own firm. And the kind of the solution to making money for everyone was to go public. And as we covered in enormous depth, I would say, last week, that's no longer the model, because as we know, very well. The market is awash with private equity money, which means that people don't need to go public to have that big event.
And I think it's also worth talking about the fact that the conditions for life as a public company are much harsher than life as a private company. And so I think the good example is, you know, Sam, you mentioned Focus Financial Partners. And Focus, I'll add the caveat that this is not a perfect analog because Focus, as opposed to being directly an RIA, is a financier of RIAs. But Focus, I mean, look, you know, I remember writing about Focus IPO happening like 3 months into my job here. And every time I wrote up the earnings story, it seemed like the leverage situation for Focus was persistently a question, that they would trade in the 4 to 5x leverage range. And the analysts were concerned that was pretty high. But, you know, you look at what Focus is now. I mean, in January, we broke that Focus is going to do a dividend recap, raising $800 million. That bumped their leverage ratio up to about 5.8x, about 6. Nobody batted an eye. So a lot of these private held RIAs, especially ones that have gone through multiple rounds of PE backing, they're more levered up. The PE firms think they can do that because, again, these businesses generate strong free cash flow. And yeah, public markets don't like leverage businesses. They get worried about it. So yeah, you can operate, you can have much more operating leverage as a private company than a public company. That's part one. We get to part two in a second.
Okay, so well, let's get to part two. Well, my question was going to be, are there any contenders? So if we say 2030 or 2028 to 2030, of which just over 40% of our survey responders said there might be something happening by then. Do you think that part of it's right, Ian? And if so, who might be?
I think that it's possible. I think, though, that the main issue is that the public markets don't view independent RIAs the same way that private equity firms do. A lot of times they've traded at multiples similar to asset managers, which makes sense because it's both market-linked revenue. But I think the big difference is that RIAs are generally growing with market appreciation. And yes, we talk about organic growth and that's hard to come by, but there are some firms that are growing. And in contrast, you know, many asset managers are dealing with secular outflows. That's a secular trend. Like we write about like the T. Rose of the world. We always write about how maybe the outflows haven't reversed. It's good news, not the outflows have reversed, but that they're getting less bad. And so the multiples that an asset manager is going to trade in are going to be more in line in the teens as opposed to the strongest RIAs that trade in a 24, 25, 26 multiple range. Firm that's trading in that range that could go public would be Creative Planning, I think, down the line, because that's a mature business, a very sticky asset, sticky client base, high organic growth, and crucially, arguably underlevered to the rest of the market. They've only taken two small rounds of PE investment, First Journal Atlantic back in about 2020, and then the deal with TPG last year. And so that's a firm that has the structure that could go public down the line.
And we've reported a little bit about, I suppose, this. Can you report something not happening? Yes, you can. Is it as exciting as something happening? No, it's not. But we've reported a bit, Ian, about at least one large broker-dealer sort of saying it's in no rush to do so. And there's another example I think you have of a firm that sort of maybe could, but decided not to.
Yeah. I mean, Ozaic is a great example. I mean, I spoke to their CEO, Jamie Price, and he said, yeah, I mean, at some point, this probably is going to be a public company. But he pretty much said explicitly, there's no rush, that their private equity owner, Reverence Capital Partners, has them in, I believe, off the top of my head, a 10-year fund. So yeah, there's no rush to monetize. There's no reason for them to get out anytime soon. Why wouldn't Reverence just hold them and then do some incremental M&A? Case in point, we wrote on Monday of this week that Ozaic bought CW Advisors, which is a $13.5 billion RIA. So yeah, they have plenty of capacity to operate pretty effectively as a private company. Why mess with what's working?
And what about Rockefeller? You know, again, listener, let you into the secrets here. Sometimes we talk about what we're going to talk about before we talk about it. You mentioned Rockefeller as an example, again, of something that's of a firm that effectively can raise enough money or decide not to do something by going public, but otherwise in a different world might have been a candidate.
Yeah, I've basically just been breadcrumbing the listeners for the last couple of minutes. So yeah, I mean, Rockefeller Capital Management, again, similar. actually kind of similar business to Hightower, including the black logo scheme, the black color scheme. Serial Recruiter of Wirehouse Brokers. They do some RIA acquisitions. They also had some private bank advisors. Yeah, they were a firm that had been mentioned to me casually in recent weeks as a firm that could potentially go public. But again, we broke on Monday that they raised about $150 million, but they took out debt capital. And the types of leveraged syndicated loans that a firm like Rockefeller can take out, much easier to do as a private as a privately owned company, especially with a PE sponsor, which Rockefeller has in the form of Viking Global Investors. Yeah, it's a lot easier to do those types of transactions as a private company. So, look, I mean, I'm sure IPO advisors hate hearing this, but they know it's kind of true. It's pretty difficult right now to get a company public. There's a lot of things out there that are disincentivizing you from going public.
Okay, so look, you heard it here first. Don't expect any exciting wealth management IPOs for the near future. I want to touch on the other main question that we asked our audience of 30, 40 sort of RIA CIOs, which was around what was making them nervous right now from an investment point of view. And the answer here, well, I don't want to steal your thunder entirely, Sam, but was private credit, with 45% of those surveyed saying that was, admittedly, they had only four options to choose from. But what was also interesting was they also told us, and you can give me the exact stats on this, that this was also an area where they were seeing lots of demand from clients.
Yep, that's right. Yep, they said, about 35% of our respondents said that they're seeing private credit as kind of being the source of the most client demand. And that was tied with real estate also. So clients are really interested in that.
Yeah, that sort of private side of things, which is kind of, you know, it fits with what we're hearing, isn't it? And I think we've seen it a lot in the launches that have happened this year in sort of allocations that we know that various of our readers have made. Did anyone give reasons as to what their sort of concerns were on the private credit side, as to sort of why they thought this was maybe giving them pause?
Yeah, well, I think like just the rise in client interest in it has, you know, kind of gone hand in hand with you know, being concerned as they're, you know, as they continue to monitor the asset. Obviously, there's been you know, the specter, I guess, of interest rate changes by the Fed that could impact private credit investments. So yeah, those are all factors at play.
I think you guys mentioned there was at least one guy who kind of made the point that people like the return profile that it offers, but maybe are less clear on what the underlying investments might be and the nuance around them as well.
Yeah. Some clients don't really understand some of the sub asset classes there, within the private credit space.
Yeah, I suppose the argument would be, well, that's the advisor's job, right? To educate them, to get them up to speed on it.
Yeah. But,
Ian, did you hear much from attendees on this point?
No, I mean, not directly, unfortunately. It's kind of tough when you're chairing, you're kind of bouncing from place to place. But I did let people know on stage while pointing at Sam, saying he's the guy to talk to.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I mean, look, obviously, it's been a sort of huge story of the last sort of 2-3 years, hasn't it? The expansion of that market. We all know the background to that around sort of banks lending less and sort of lenders stepping into that, in private credit funds stepping in to be that lender effectively to many of these firms. And it's a really interesting trend. We're also obviously seeing loads of asset managers from both the sort of those that were traditionally private credit and equity firms, but also those that were traditionally sort of long-only public market firms, both trying to ramp up their alternative capabilities and, for want of a better phrase, sort of push them into the wealth channel, obviously, as their traditional institutional clients kind of dry up's the wrong word, but have less money to continue to allocate to that space. They've got to find new space for growth, and clearly people have looked at the wealth market and seen just how big it is, how big some of those clients are, you know, off the back of some pretty tasty markets in the US and things, and realize that this is a really good place for them to try and play. And it will be really interesting to see over the next few years how that plays out. I guess there's currently a lot of lobbying, let's say, around getting private assets into, say, 401k plans, and that would obviously make a big difference to that space too.
Yeah, that and lowering the accredited investor threshold.
Yeah, and that dates back. That dates back years. That pushed below the accredited investor threshold. I remember writing about that back in the day.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess also, obviously, more and more people are accredited investors than used to be the case, right? And again, as we all know, there's greater access to these products than there used to be too. Like, maybe you did used to have to be part of one of the big private banks to get into them. But as we see more and more evergreen funds, and obviously there's technological advances via the likes of Case and iCapital making these things more available, I think it's going to be a bigger part of RIA's portfolios going forwards. So maybe a question that we continue to ask as we monitor both the growth, but perhaps also the concerns that our readers or indeed listeners might have. Excellent. I want to move on from San Diego in a minute, but before we leave the sunny old La Jolla, were there any other observations that either of you two had from the conference, from your, you know, from your cocktails, dare I say it,
chit chat
with the advisor community?
Yeah, I had a lot of interesting discussions. I talked to Karina Diamond, who's now the CEO of a roughly $2 billion firm in Cleveland called GFP Private Wealth. We talked a lot about succession planning for advisors, which is, you know, kind of on every firm's mind with the, you know, given the average age of the advisor in this country, basically. But she just talked about, you know, I'm introducing some of the, you know, introducing the right incentives to senior advisors to kind of turn over their books of business.
What are those incentives? What do you do?
Just having, you know,
bags of cash,
having better, well, that could help, but yeah. No, I mean, like, part of it is like, just like the ability to have like better relationships with the second generation. You know, that can be an incentive to introduce a younger advisor, and also like, more adept use of like, of different technology tools, you know, that like an older advisor might not have.
So the younger clients can bring some, sorry, the younger advisors rather can be bringing something to the table. It's not just a case of taking someone else's clients and, you know, running.
They can be a value add. If it's presented in the right way. And yeah.
Really interesting. Ian, did you hear much on succession planning, or what was your sort of takeaway with regards vibe or sort of topics of conversation?
Well, I think what's great is that we get a lot of insight into the speaker feedback that we get. And, you know, I hinted at it briefly. We talked to Kurt Mashinsky on stage. I did a nice fireside chat with him. He's the CEO of Cerity Partners, RIA with north of $120 billion in assets. And people were really fascinated, and it really resonated with them how Kurt personally has never taken chips off the table, that he stayed all in with Cerity Partners, sorry, through.
They get very annoyed about that.
They do.
Let's joke about that for a minute. They get very, like, if a podcast is for nothing else, it's for settling scores. Don't call them Cerity. They don't like it.
No, they don't.
There's
an insurance firm called Cerity.
Insurance. I suppose it's finance enough, you know, yeah. All right, anyway.
But he's rolled through multiple private equity investments. And I think it's just kind of telling that, yeah, like they've talked about spreading the wealth. They do a lot of deals where they use equity to bring partners in when they're doing transactions. So I think that just their approach to spreading the wealth, even with institutional sponsorship, it did seem, to your succession planning point, like it did resonate with advisors.
Yeah, and it's obviously a topic. Not everyone can necessarily do what they do. They may not have the size. They may not have the bags of cash that having some of those big institutional investors might give. But obviously they probably set a pretty high sort of bar for what best practice might be, and given that it's front of mind for firms of all sizes, perhaps not surprising that it resonates.
I did get some listener feedback too
on the pod.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Do you want to share it? Is it good feedback?
I mean, for me, it was let Ian make more jokes.
Let Ian make more. I don't believe that was real feedback.
It was from my wife.
It was from your wife.
Yeah,
but that doesn't count. I'm talking feedback from the conference. All feedback welcome, including from me as wife. Good. And feel free to make as many jokes as you want. And sorry if I've ever cramped your style. Okay, San Diego, done. Thank you both. Glad to have you both back. Two more stories quickly before we go then. So Sam, this is a bit of a Sam Bojarski special, actually. Almost like we planned it. I wanted to talk to you about a deal now. Regular readers will know that there are deals almost every day. So why talk about anyone in particular? But this one was a bit more unusual, perhaps, than those that we see on a more regular basis.
Yeah, we reported yesterday that NerdWallet, which
just
people
quickly,
know, but
recording on Thursday, podcast out on Friday, so we reported on Wednesday.
Yes, couple days ago. We reported that on NerdWallet, which, you know, many people know is a personal finance education company. Consumers can compare loans and rates and things like that. They have bought a, you know, small New York City RIA with and plan to kind of build out a wealth management offering, which is fascinating.
Yeah, because I guess obviously they're a consumer brand and they obviously have, I imagine, hundreds of thousands, millions of people who've engaged with that website who are obviously interested in some form of financial decision, however sort of small and one-off that decision might be, such as, you know, picking a credit card. It's not something that you do every week, but obviously they're somewhat financially aware users, and I would imagine the idea here is some of those people will continue to come to them, and when they do, they can say, well, we can also offer you further services, for example, model portfolios or some form of financial advice.
Mm-hmm. It's investment management services, estate planning, financial planning, pretty much the whole gamut of what an RIA does can be offered by this firm, which is called NerdWallet Wealth Partners.
And what was the firm they bought?
They bought this firm called Future U Wealth, roughly $178 million RIA, which was founded by this guy, this advisor, Ryan Sterling.
Okay, great. And what did we know about NerdWallet's plans? Did we know they were going to do this? Did it come out of the blue? Was there sort of any more context here that we should be aware of?
We didn't know, but the writing was on the wall per se. Yeah, they rolled out a subscription based RIA, I believe, last year. Works with clients, on a non AUM fee basis. And they also recently rolled out a service to connect people with third party financial advisors.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting. So there's a referral network as well. So there's sort of two options. You can either go to their in-house option, or I guess if you had more sophisticated needs or what have you, they'll refer you out to other RIAs. And those RIAs, what do we know? I might be asking questions we don't know the answer to. Do they pay to be a part of that? What do they get out of it? Is it a sort of a share of a fee split, perhaps?
Yeah, there's. I believe there's a couple different ways they can pay, but I think part of it is based on the AUM that gets referred over.
Yeah. Okay.
Really
interesting. Okay. Well, NerdWallet at least used to advertise on television and stuff, so it has that sort of big consumer brand, and I guess it'll be interesting to see if it can sort of take that and pivot that into, more traditional wealth management.
Increasingly, it seems that they will be able to handle some of the complex planning. You know, I think that was part of the shtick here with this new RIA offering.
Okay, so hang on. Here's an irony. NerdWallet, a public company?
They are public, yes. Mm-hmm.
So would that be? Hey, is that a little backdoor wealth management IPO just there? Did all our survey take us wrong? Or obviously, it's not quite that. It's in the ballpark.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, excellent. Right, well, we've got one more story before we go. Unless, Ian, you wanted to come in on that deal at all. Obviously, our resident deal czar. Did you have any further thoughts on that particular acquisition?
No, I mean, I think that Sam's reporting speaks for itself. He's done a very thorough job there.
Excellent. Look at that. What a great boss. Okay, final story, which actually came out at the end of last week, but this is about the SEC and its bonfire of... It's not even a bonfire of regulations. They weren't regulations. They were proposals. But it dropped 14, if that's correct.
Yeah.
Potential proposals or rules that were kind of in the mix. Yeah. Tell us about it, Sam.
Yeah. They basically nixed 14 proposals in total that were proposed during the tenure of former chair Gary Gensler. About five of those proposals, I think, directly pertained to RIAs. Those included proposals on asset custody, outsourcing, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence.
Excellent. And were they, look, we don't have to get into the nitty gritty of them because look, they're gone, who cares? But were they likely to have been particularly onerous? Were they things that people have had problems with? And I suppose then the obvious follow-up to that, will people basically all be pretty chilled these have gone away? Or is anyone there going, hey, that was really smart, I wish we were doing that still?
Yeah, I think like pretty unanimously industry-wide, there's been a cheer after, you know, after the SEC got rid of some of these proposals, which isn't a surprise to us. But yeah, I mean, like folks were like very concerned that, you know, that these proposals, if they were enacted, would become, you know, quite onerous. I mean, there's the proposal that related to AI, you know, advisors would have had to put out more significant reporting on some of these technologies and what kind of like conflict of interest concerns they would introduce to client relationships. So.
Yeah, so they were more proposals that involved a lot of kind of documentation and disclosure around potential conflicts and things like that.
Exactly, and the same with outsourcing too. You know, they would have had to do the same thing with third-party service providers if the outsourcing rule would have gone into place.
So they may not have dramatically changed practices, but they would have changed the amount of reporting that you would have had to have done around those practices. So hence why people are kind of happy.
Absolutely.
They don't have to do it. Basically, less paperwork, and I think we can pretty much all agree that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Before we go, anything else? Any other business? Any jokes, man? Come on, you've teed yourself up here.
You put me on the spot here. I'm panicking.
That's very unfair. No, but any other business, whether from San Diego or back in NYC?
I mean, you know, we're already thinking about the next conference, which, you know, will be tied to the release of 50 Grows Across America, which we've begun working on this week in earnest.
50 Grows, yes. I think we trailed it the other day on the pod as well, didn't we? When we admitted that we had finally crunched the list of 100 and, well, it's not quite 150 firms, is it? It can be up to 3 firms per state, but some states, no names mentioned, North Dakota, can't necessarily get to 3. But yeah, long list of firms, lots of work goes into the sort of the quant process of crunching the numbers. And then even more work goes into the vetting of those firms and then the reaching out to write it. So that should, okay. So here, Ian, not really a joke to end on, but a promise, when's it going to go live?
We're shooting for mid-July.
Mid-July. Okay. Well, you know where to find it, listener. I think we'll leave it there. So just a big thank you to you, Ian. Thanks very much indeed for joining us. And Sam, star of the show today, thank you very much. Great to have you back in the studio. Listener, great to have you back too. And we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.